name of what's word, serving to your opinion to your matter. One brother had probably read the logic of the great...
Relationships don't work between black people. Racism, white supremacy is the reason.
Absolutely.
Can't get a job in the hood and you educated. Racism, white supremacy.
Absolutely.
Can't get an education in the hood because it's expensive. Racism, white supremacy.
Mm-hmm.
A poor education in the hood you live in. Racism, white supremacy.
Absolutely.
You live next to poor people who will rob your ass, steal and kill your ass because they don't have no options and they don't have no option to critically think. Racism, white supremacy.
Yeah.
And I see that that's a problem. So I wanted to just make a pimp decision.
$1 trillion flow.
$1 trillion.
From LA to Miami. Minnesota to Detroit. Chicago. Alabama. Texas. $1 trillion flow. Houston. $1 trillion. New Orleans. Bill Street. People of Maryland, flow. Atlanta, Georgia, flow. The $1 billion flow. Over enough. Enough for everybody. It was made for us to be rich. Made for us to be brilliant. People of color. People of color. You ask not, you have not. We ask it for what's ours. We are calling for you, you and you, to come into the $1 billion float. New car, new home. New land, new expression. A new philosophy. A new love. $1 billion float. $1 trillion float. We are able to have more money than the government, because we are the government. $1 trillion flow coming from Egypt. Coming from the mother country, Africa, to New York and Chicago, the birthplace of Malcolm X, the birthplace of Martin Luther King, Dusab. I'm talking about $1 trillion flow, the slave train. I'm talking about Paul Lawrence done by Robeson, the slave train, the $1 billion flow. You and me, me and you. Poor and rich. We are rich because we're in the $1 billion flow. Yes, you can have that new Benz. Yes, you can have that Beamer. Yes, you can have that Rose. Yes, you can have that Cadillac. Yes, you can have that up on the hill up in New York, up in California, out in Oakland, Compton, L.A. You can have the $1 billion. Yo. 100%. You 100% deal. You 100% woman. You 100% man. You 100% up with your effort. I'm talking about the $1 billion flow. We are right for getting what belongs to us. Give me what you owe me, and you owe me $1 billion flow. I want what's mine. I want to have the best of life. I want the sun to shine on me. I want my fellas to wake up. People of color all over the world is in the $1 billion flow. Maybe you in Atlanta, Georgia. Maybe you in down in California. Maybe you in Texas. Maybe you in New York. Maybe you in Florida. Maybe you in Canada, but you in the $1 billion. Maybe you in St. Paul, Minnesota. Indianapolis, Indiana, which is about the $1 billion flow. It's going on up in New York, in Chicago, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, New Orleans. It's going on, the $1 billion flow. Down in Texas, Arkansas, North Carolina, South Carolina, Phoenix, Las Vegas, New York. We're calling for the $1 billion flow. I see you rise up and be brilliant. Say I'm rich, because I'm in the $1 billion flow. I am the original man. I am the original woman. I must have my respect. I must have my education. I must have $1 billion. I must be rich. I must lift my brothers and sisters out of the ghetto and out of poverty. I'm in the $1 billion flow. Get what I want. Have what I want. I can get it now. Right. I'm in the $1 billion flow. Look at somebody. I'm in the $1 billion flow on my car. I'm in the $1 billion flow in my business. I'm in the $1 billion flow. Why don't you get in the flow of the billionaire?
It is a question of whether we are making any real progress in the struggle to make racial justice a reality in the United States of America. And whenever I seek to answer that question, on the one hand, I seek to avoid an undue pessimism. On the other hand, I seek to avoid a superficial optimism. And I try to incorporate or develop what I consider a realistic position by admitting on the one hand that we have made many significant strides over the last few years in the struggle for racial justice, but by admitting that before the problem is solved, we still have numerous things to do and many challenges to meet. And it is this realistic position that I would like to use as a basis for our thinking together tonight as we think about the problem in the United States. We have come a long, long way, but we have a long, long way to go before the problem is solved. Now let us notice first that we've come a long, long way, and I would like to say at this point that the Negro himself has come a long, long way in re-evaluating his own intrinsic worth. Now, in order to illustrate this, a little history is necessary. It was in the year 1619 when the first Negro slaves landed on the shores of America. And they were brought there from the soils of Africa. Unlike the Pilgrim Fathers who landed at Plymouth a year later, they were brought there against their will. And throughout slavery, the Negro was treated in a very inhuman fashion. He was a thing to be used, not a person to be respected. The United States Supreme Court rendered a decision in 1857 known as the Dred Scott decision, which well illustrated this whole idea and which well illustrated what existed at that time. But in this decision, the Supreme Court of the United States said in substance that the Negro is not a citizen of the United States. He is merely property subject to the dictates of his owner. And it went on to say that the Negro has no right that the white man is bound to respect. This was the idea that prevailed during the days of slavery. With the growth of slavery, it became necessary to give some justification for it. You know, it seems to be a fact of life that human beings cannot continue to do wrong without eventually reaching out for some thin rationalization to clothe an obvious wrong in the beautiful garments of righteousness. And this is exactly what happened during the days of slavery. There were those who even misused the Bible and religion to give some justification for slavery and to crystallize the patterns of the status quo. So it was argued from some pulpits that the Negro was inferior by nature because of Noah's curse upon the children of Ham. Then the Apostle Paul's dictum became a watchword, "Servants, be obedient to your master." One brother had probably read the logic of the great philosopher Aristotle. You know, Aristotle did a great deal to bring into being what we now know as formal logic in philosophy. an informal logic that is a big word known as the syllogism, which has a major premise, a minor premise, and a conclusion. And so this brother decided to put his argument for the inferiority of the Negro in the framework of an Aristotelian syllogism. He could say all men are made in the image of God. This was the major premise. Then came the minor premise. God, as everybody knows, is not a Negro. Therefore, the Negro is not a man. This was the kind of reasoning that prevailed. Well, living with the conditions of slavery and then later segregation, many Negroes lost faith in themselves. Many came to feel that perhaps they were less than human. Many came to feel that they were inferior. This, it seems to me, is the greatest tragedy of slavery, the greatest tragedy of segregation, not merely what it does to the individual physically, but what it does to one psychologically. It scars the soul of the segregated as well as the segregator. It gives the segregator a false sense of superiority while leaving the segregated with a false sense of inferiority. This is exactly what happened. Then something happened to the Negro. Circumstances made it possible and necessary for him to travel more. The coming of the automobile, the upheavals of two world wars, the Great Depression. And so his rural plantation background gradually gave way to urban industrial life. His economic life was gradually rising through the growth of industry, the development of organized labor and expanded educational opportunities. Even his cultural life was gradually rising through the steady decline of crippling illiteracy. All of these forces conjoined to cause the Negro in America to take a new look at himself. Negro masses all over began to reevaluate themselves. And then something else happened along with all of this. The Negro in the United States turned his eyes and his mind to Africa. He noticed the magnificent drama of independence taking place on the stage of African history. Noticing the developments, noticing what was happening, noticing what was being done on the part of his black brothers and sisters in Africa, gave him a new sense of dignity in the United States and a new sense of self-respect. The Negro came to feel that he was somebody. His religion revealed to him that God loves all of his children and that all men are made in his image. And that the basic thing about a man is not his specificity, but his fundamental. Not the texture of his hair or the color of his skin, but his eternal dignity and worth. So the Negro in America could now cry out unconsciously with the eloquent voice, fleecy locks and black complexion cannot forfeit nature's claim. Skin may differ, but affection dwells in black and white the same. And were I so tall as to reach the pole or to grasp the ocean at a span, I must be measured by my soul. The mind is the standard of the man. And with this new sense of dignity and this new sense of self-respect, a new Negro came into being with a new determination to suffer, to struggle, to sacrifice, and even to die if necessary in order to be free. This reveals that we have come a long, long way since 1619. But if we're to be true to the facts, it is necessary to say that not only has the Negro re-evaluated his own intrinsic worth, the whole nation has come a long, long way in extending the frontiers of civil rights. Now, I'd like to mention just a few things that have happened in our country which reveal this. 50 years ago, or even 25 years ago, A year hardly passed when numerous Negroes were not brutally lynched by some vicious mob. Unfortunately, lynchings have about ceased today. If one would go back to the turn of the century, you would find that in the southern part of the United States, you had very few Negroes registered to vote. By 1948, that number had leaped to about 750,000. 1960, it leaped to 1,200,000. When we went into the presidential election just a few weeks ago, that number had leaped to more than 2 million. We went into that election with more than 2 million Negroes registered to vote in the South, which meant that we in the civil rights movement, by working hard, we've been able to add more than 800,000 new Negroes as registered voters in the last 3 years. This reveals that we've made strides. Then when we look at the question of economic justice, as much to do, but we can at least say that some strides have been made. The average Negro wage earner who is employed today in the United States earns 10 times more than the average Negro wage earner 12 years ago. The national income of the Negro is now a little better than $28 billion a year, which is all more than all of the exports of the United States and more than the national budget of Canada. This reveals that we have made some strides in this area. But probably more than anything else, and you've read about it so much here and all over the world, I'm sure, we have noticed a gradual decline, even demise, of the systems of racial segregation. Now, the legal history of racial segregation beginning in 1896. Many people feel that racial segregation has been a reality in the United States for a long, long time. But the fact is that this was a rather recent phenomenon in our country, just a little better than 60 years old. But it had its legal beginning with a decision known as the Plessy versus Ferguson decision, which said in substance that separate but equal facilities could exist, and it made the doctrine of separate but equal the law of the land. We all know what happened as a result of the old Plessy doctrine. That was always a strict enforcement of the separate, without the slightest intention to abide by the equal. The Negro ended up being plunged into the abyss of exploitation, where he experienced the bleakness of nagging injustice. Then something marvelous happened. The Supreme Court of our nation in 1954 examined the legal body of segregation and on May 17th of that year pronounced it constitutionally dead. Said in substance that the old Plessy doctrine must go, that separate facilities are inherently unequal, and that the segregated child on the basis of his race is to deny that child equal protection of the law. So we've seen many changes since that momentous decision was rendered in 1954. It came as a great beacon light of hope to millions of disinherited people all over our nation. Then something else happened, which brought joy to all of our hearts, happened this year. It was last year after the struggle in Birmingham, Alabama. The late President Kennedy came to realize that was a basic issue that our country had to grapple with, with a sense of concern and a sense of immediacy. He made a great speech. Two days before, rather it was really on the same day that the University of Alabama was to be integrated, and Governor Wallace stood in the door and tried to block that integration. Mr. Kennedy had to have the National Guard federalized, stood before the nation and said in eloquent terms, the problem which we face in the area of civil rights, not merely It is not merely an economic issue. It is at bottom of moral issue. It is as old as the scriptures and as modern as the Constitution. It is a question of whether we will treat our Negro brothers as we ourselves would like to be treated. On the heels of that great speech, he went and recommended to the Congress of our nation the most comprehensive civil rights bill ever recommended by any president of our great nation. Fortunately, after many months of battle, for a period we got a little tired of that. You know, there are some men in our country who like to talk a lot. Maybe you've read about the filibuster. And you know, they get bogged down in the paralysis of analysis. They will just go on and on and on, and they wanted to talk that bill to death. President Lyndon Johnson got to work. He started calling congressmen and senators in, started meeting day in and day out with influential people in the country. Clearly, that bill had to pass. A tribute to the late President Kennedy, but also as a tribute to the greatness of the country, as an expression of its dedication to the American dream. It was that great day last month. That bill came into being. It was on July 2nd that Mr. Johnson signed that bill, and it became the law of the land. So in America now, we have a civil rights bill. I'm happy to report to you that by and large, that bill is being implemented in communities all across the South. We have seen some surprising levels of compliance, even in some communities in the state of Mississippi. Whenever you can find anything right in Mississippi, things are getting better. So we've come a long, long way since 1896. Now, this would be a wonderful place for me to end my speech. First, it would mean making a relatively short speech, and that would be a magnificent accomplishment for a Baptist preacher. Second, it would mean that the problem is about solving. You know, it would be wonderful if I could go around the world. I wish I could, and if I could go around America and talk about this problem, it's a problem that once existed, but that no longer has existed. I wish I could do that. But you know, if I stop at this point, I will merely be stating a fact and not telling the truth. To see a fact is merely the absence of contradiction, but truth is the presence of coherence. Truth is the relatedness of fact. Now, it's a fact that we've come a long, long way, but it isn't the whole truth. In order to get the whole truth, you've got to add the other side. And I'm afraid if I stop at this point, I will leave you, my dear friends of London, the victims of a dangerous optimism. If I stop here, I'll leave you the victims of an illusion wrapped in superficiality. So in order to tell the truth, it's necessary to move on and say not only have we come a long, long way, but we have a long, long way to go before the problem it's solved. I don't think I need to stay on this point very long. You read the newspapers, you look at your television, you know what's happening. You know what is happening on an almost day-to-day basis. I mentioned the fact that lynchings have about ceased, but other things are happening. We are not unmindful of the fact that we cannot forget it. But just last year, four little children were murdered in Birmingham, Alabama, in the Church of God on Sunday morning. Thank you. I'm very happy to hear from my good friend up there. I continue to speak. I can talk a little louder than you can. Now, on the other issue, we should never forget the fact that just this summer, three civil rights workers were brutally murdered near Philadelphia, Mississippi. All of this reveals to us that we have not achieved the level of brotherhood. We have not achieved the brotherhood that we need and that we must have in our nation. We still long, long way to go. I mentioned voter registration and the fact that we have been able to add about 800,000 new registered voters in the last 2 or 3 years, the fact that it's over 2 million now, I guess that sounded like real progress, and it does represent some progress. But let me give you another side. That is the fact that there are still more than 10 million Negroes living in the southern part of the United States. Some 6 million the Negroes living in the southern part of the United States are voting age, yet only 2 million are registered. This means that 4 million remain unregistered. Not merely because they are apathetic, not because they are complacent. This may be true of some too, because all types of conniving methods are still being used to keep Negroes from becoming registered voters. Complex literacy tests are given, which make it almost impossible for anybody to pass the test. Even if he has a PhD degree in any field or a law degree from the best law schools of the world, then actual economic reprisals are often taken out against Negroes who seek to register and vote in some of the Black Belt counties of Mississippi and Alabama and other places. Then some are actually faced with physical violence, sometimes physical death. This reveals that we have great deal that must be done in this area. I mentioned economic justice. I'm sure that figure, $28 billion, sounds very large. That's a lot of money. Then I must go on and give you the other side, if I'm to be honest about the picture. That is the fact that 42% of the Negro families in the United States still earn less than $2,000 a year, while just 16% of the white families earn less than $2,000 a year, 21% of the Negro families of America earn less than $1,000 a year, while just 5% of the white families earn less than $1,000 a year. Then we face the fact that 88% of the Negro families of America earn less than $5,000 a year, while just 58% of the white families earn less than $5,000 a year. So we can see that that is still a great goal. Between the have, so to speak, and the have-not. If America is to continue to grow and progress and develop, move on toward its strength, this problem must be solved. Now, this economic problem is getting more serious because of many forces alive in our world, in our nation. For many years, Negroes were denied adequate educational opportunities. For many years, Negroes were even denied apprenticeship training. So the forces of labor and industry so often discriminated against Negroes. This meant the Negro ended up being limited by and large to unskilled and semi-skilled labor. Now, because of the forces of automation and cybernation, these are the jobs that are now passing away. So when Negro wakes up in a city like Detroit, Michigan, discovers that he's 28% of the population and about 72% are unemployed. In order to grapple with that problem, our federal government will have to develop massive retraining programs, massive public works programs, so that automation can be a blessing, as it must be, to our society and not a curse. Then the other thing, when we think of this economic problem, we must think of the fact that that is nothing more dangerous than to build a society with a segment in that society which feels that it has no stake in the society. Nothing more dangerous than to build society with a number of people who see life as little more than a long and desolate corridor with no exit sign. They end up with despair because they have no job, because they can't educate their children, because they can't live in a nice home, because they can't have adequate health facilities. We always hear of the various reasons why and the various myths concerning integration and why integration shouldn't come into being. So you integrate public schools, for instance, you will pull the white race back a generation. They like to talk about the cultural lag in the Negro community. Then they go on to say, now, you know, the Negro is a criminal. He has the highest crime rate in any city that you can find in the United States. The arguments go on ad infinitum. Why integration should come into being. But I think there's an answer to that. That is, that there is cultural lag in the Negro community, and there certainly is. This lag is there because of segregation and discrimination. There because of long years of slavery and segregation. Criminal responses are not racial, but environmental. Poverty, economic deprivation, social isolation, all of these things breed crime, whatever the racial group may be. And it is a torturous process to use the tragic results of racial segregation as an argument for the continuation of it. It is necessary to go back.
You are listening to the newly discovered Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. speech at the City Temple Hall in London on Monday evening, 7:30 p.m., December 7th, 1964. For more information on this recording or other recordings of Dr. Martin Luther King, please visit Pacifica Radio Archives or call us in the archives at 1-800-735-0230. And now back to Dr. Martin Luther King from London.
So it is necessary to see this. To go all out to make economic justice a reality all over our nation. I mentioned that racial segregation is about dead in the United States, but it's still with us. We are about past the day of legal segregation. We have about ended de jure segregation where the laws of a nation or of a particular state can uphold because of the Civil Rights Bill and the Supreme Court decision and other things. We have passed the day when the Negro can't eat at a lunch counter, with the exception of a few isolated situations, where the Negro can't check in a motel or a hotel. We are fastly passing that day. That is another form of segregation coming up. It is coming up through housing discrimination, joblessness, and the de facto segregation in the public schools. So the ghettoized conditions that exist make for many problems, and it makes for hard core de facto segregation that we must grapple with on a day-to-day basis. So this is the problem that we face, and this is the problem that we are forced to deal with. We are going to deal with it in a determined way. I am absolutely convinced that segregation is on its deathbed, and those who represent it, whether they be in the United States or whether they be in London, England, the system is on its deathbed. But certainly we all know that if democracy is to live in any nation, segregation must die. As I've tried to say all over America, we've got to get rid of segregation, not merely because it will help our image, it certainly will help our image in the world. We've got to get rid of segregation, not merely because it will appeal to Asian and African peoples, and this certainly will be helpful, this is important. But in the final analysis, racial discrimination must be uprooted from American society and from every society, because it is morally wrong. So it is necessary to go all out and develop massive action programs to get rid of racial segregation. Now, I would like to mention one or two ideas that circulate in our society, and they probably circulate in your society and all over the world, that keep us from developing the kind of action programs necessary to get rid of discrimination and segregation. One is what I refer to as the myth of time. There are those individuals who argue that only time can solve the problem of racial injustice in the United States, in South Africa, or anywhere else. You've got to wait on time. And I know they've said to us so often in the States and to our allies in the white community, just be nice and be patient and continue to pray, and in 100 or 200 years, the problem will work itself out. We've heard and we've lived with the myth of time. The only answer that I can give to that myth is that time is neutral. It can be used either constructively or destructively. I must honestly say to you that I'm convinced that the forces of ill will have often used time much more effectively than the forces of goodwill. We may have to repent in this generation, not merely for the vitriolic words and the violent actions of the bad people, but for the appalling silence and indifference of the good people who sit around saying, wait on time. Somewhere along the way, it is necessary to see that human progress never rolls in on the wheels of inevitability. It comes through the tireless efforts and the persistent work of dedicated individuals who are willing to be co-workers with God. And without this hard work, time itself becomes an ally of the primitive forces of social stagnation. So we must help time. We must realize that the time is always right to do right. This is so vital. This is so necessary. Now, the other myth that gets around a great deal in our nation, and I'm sure in other nations of the world, is the idea that you can't solve the problems in the realm of human relations through legislation. You can't solve the housing problem and the job problem and all of these other problems through legislation. You've got to change the heart. We had a presidential candidate just recently who spoke about this a great deal, and I think Mr. Goldwater sincerely believed that you couldn't do anything through legislation because he voted against everything in the Senate, including the Civil Rights Bill. And he said all over the nation throughout the election that we don't need legislation, but legislation can't deal with this problem. But he was nice enough to say that you've got to change the heart. Now, I want to at least go halfway with Brother Goldwater at that point. I think he's right. If we're going to get this problem solved in America and all over the world, ultimately, people must change their hearts where they have prejudices. If we are going to solve the problems facing mankind, I would be the first to say that every white person must look down deep within, remove every prejudice that may be there, and come to see that the Negro, the colored people generally must be treated right, not merely because the law says it, but because it is right and because it is natural. I agree with this 100%. And I'm sure that if the problem is to be solved ultimately, men must be obedient not merely to that which can be enforced by the law, but they must rise to the majestic heights of being obedient to the unenforceable. But after saying all of that, I must go on to the other side. This is where I must leave Mr. Goldwater and others who believe the legislation has no place. It may be true that you can't legislate integration, but you can legislate desegregation. It may be true that morality cannot be legislated, but behavior can be regulated. It may be true that the law can't change the heart, but it can restrain the heartless. It may be true that the law can make a man love me, but it can restrain him from lynching me. And I think that's pretty important also. So while legislation may not be able to change the hearts of men, it does change the habits of men. When you change the habits, pretty soon the attitudes and the hearts will be changed. And so that is a need, a continual basis for meaningful legislation to grapple with the problems that we face in human relations all over our nation and all over the world. Now, as you know, we have been engaged in the United States in a massive struggle to make desegregation and finally integration a reality. In that struggle, there has been an undergirding philosophy, the philosophy of nonviolence, the philosophy method of nonviolent resistance. And I'd like to say just a few words about the method or the philosophy that has undergirded our struggle. First, I want to say that I'm still convinced that nonviolence is the most potent weapon available to oppress people in their injustice. It has a way of disarming the opponent, exposing his moral defenses, weakens his morale, and at the same time it works on his conscience and he just doesn't know how to handle it. If he doesn't beat you, wonderful. If he beats you, you develop the quiet courage of accepting blows without retaliating. If he doesn't put you in jail, wonderful. Nobody with any sense loves to go to jail. But if he puts you in jail, you go in that jail and transform it from a dungeon of shame to a haven of freedom and human dignity. Even if he tries to kill you, you develop the inner conviction that there are some things so dear, some things so precious, some things so eternally true, that they are worth dying for. And if a man has not discovered something that he will die for, he isn't fit to live. This is what the nonviolent discipline says. And then the other thing about it is that it gives the individual a way of struggling to secure moral ends through moral means. One of the great debates of history has been over the whole question of ends and means. All the way back in the days of Plato's dialogues, coming on up through Machiavelli and others, there have been those individuals who argued that the end justifies the means. In a real sense, a nonviolent philosophy comes along and says that the end is pre-existent in the means. The means represent the ideal in the making and the end in process. And so that in the long run of history, immoral means cannot bring about moral ends. Somehow man must come to the point he sees the necessity of having ends and means cohering, so to speak. And this is one of the things that is basic in the nonviolent philosophy at its best. It gives one a way and a method of struggle which says that you can seek to secure moral ends through moral means. It also says that it is possible to struggle against an evil, unjust system with all your might and with all your heart and even hate that unjust system. Yet you maintain an attitude of active goodwill and understanding and even love for the perpetrators of that evil system. Now this is the most misunderstood aspect of nonviolence. This is where those who don't want to follow the nonviolent method say a lot of bad things to those of us who talk about love. But I still go on and believe in it because I am still convinced that it is love that makes the world go round. And somehow this kind of love can be a powerful force for social change. Now, I'm not talking about a weak love. I'm not talking about emotional bosh here. I'm not talking about some sentimental quality. I'm not talking about an affectionate response. It would be nonsense to urge oppressed people to love their violent oppressors in an affectionate sense, and I have never advised that. Jesus said, love your enemies. I'm happy he didn't say like your enemies. It's pretty difficult to like some people. But love is greater than like. Love is understanding, creative, redemptive goodwill for all men. Theologians talk about this kind of love with the Greek word agape, which is a sort of overflowing love that seeks nothing in return. And when one develops this, you rise to the position of being able to love the person who does the evil deed while hating the deed that the person does. I believe that this can be done. Psychiatrists are telling us now that hatred is a dangerous force, not merely for the hated, but also the hater. Many of the strange things that happen in the subconscious, many of the inner conflicts are rooted in hate. And so they are saying love or perish. This is why Eric Fromm can write a book entitled The Art of Loving, arguing that love is the supreme unifying force of life. So it is wonderful to have a Methodist struggle where it is possible to stand up against segregation, to stand up against colonialism with all of your might, and yet not hate the perpetrators of these unjust systems. And I believe firmly that it is through this kind of powerful, nonviolent action, this kind of love that organizes itself into mass action, that we will be able to transform the jangling discord of our nation and the world into a beautiful symphony of brotherhood. Certainly, this is the great challenge facing us. Now, I think that nonviolence can work not only in the situation that we find in our country, not only with the magnificent example that we have in India, expressed through the marvelous work of Mohandas K. Gandhi, but I think it can work in ways and in circumstances that we haven't seen it or we haven't used it before. And in this context, I would like to say something about South Africa. And I'd like to read just a statement that I've written here so that I'll be sure that I'll say everything that I have in mind about the South African situation without missing anything. I understand there are here tonight South Africans, some of whom have been involved in the long struggle for freedom there, and our struggle for freedom and justice in the United States, which has also been so long and difficult. We feel a powerful sense of identification with those in the far more deadly struggle for freedom in South Africa. We know how Africans there and their friends of other races strove for half a century to win their freedom by nonviolent methods. We have honored Chief Luthuli for his leadership, and we know how this nonviolence was only met by increasing violence from the state, increasing repression, culminating in the shooting at Sharpeville and all that has happened since. Clearly, there's much in Mississippi and Alabama to remind the South Africans of their own country. Yet even in Mississippi, we can organize to register Negro voters. We can speak to the press. We can, in short, organize the people in nonviolent action. But in South Africa, even the mildest form of nonviolent resistance meets with years of imprisonment. Leaders over many years have been restricted and silenced and imprisoned. We can understand how in that situation people felt so desperate that they turned to other methods such as sabotage. Today, great leaders like Nelson Mandela and Robert Sobukwe are among the many hundreds wasting away in Robben Island prison against a massive, armed, and ruthless state which uses tortured and sadistic forms of interrogation to crush human beings, even driving some to suicide. The militant opposition inside South Africa seems for the moment to be silent. The mass of the people seems to be contained, seems for the moment unable to break from the oppression. I emphasize the word "the seems" because we can imagine what emotions and plans must be seething below the calm surface of that prosperous police state. We know what emotions are seething in the rest of Africa and indeed all over the world. The dangers of a race war, these dangers we have had repeated profound warning. It is in this situation, with the great mass of South Africans denied their humanity, their dignity, denied opportunity, denied all human rights, it is in this situation many of the bravest and best South Africans serving long years of prison, in prison, with some already executed. In this situation, we in America and Britain have a unique responsibility. For it is we, through our investment, through our government's failure to act decisively, who are guilty of bolstering up the South African tyranny. Our responsibility responsibility presents us with a unique opportunity. We can join in the one form of nonviolent action that to bring freedom and justice to South Africa, the action which African leaders have appealed for, a massive movement for economic sanctions in a world living under the appalling shield of nuclear weapons. Do we not recognize the need to perfect the use of economic pressures? Why is trade regarded by all nations and all ideologies as sacred? Why does our government and your government in Britain refuse to intervene effectively now, as if only when that is a bloodbath in South Africa or the Korea or the Vietnam will they recognize the crisis? If the United Kingdom and the United States decided tomorrow morning not to buy South African goods, not to buy South African gold, to put an embargo on oil, if our investors and capitalists would withdraw their support for the racial tyranny that we find there, then apartheid would be brought to an end. Then the majority of South Africans of all races could at last build the shared society they desire. So this is the challenge facing the nations of the world. God grant that we will meet this challenge, be a part of that great creative movement that will seek to bring about change and transform those dark yesterdays of man's inhumanity to man into bright tomorrows of justice and peace and goodwill. May I say to you that the problem of racial injustice is not limited to any one nation. We know now that this is a problem spreading all over the globe, right here in London and right here in England. You know so well that thousands and thousands of colored people are migrating here from many, many lands, the West Indies, from Pakistan, from India, from Africa. They have the just right to come to this great land. They have the just right to expect justice and democracy in this land. England must be eternally vigilant. But if not, the same kind of ghettos will develop that we have in the Harlems of the United States. The same problems of injustice, the same problems of inequality in jobs will develop. So I say to you that the challenge before every citizen of goodwill of this nation is to go all out to make democracy a reality for everybody, so that everybody in this land will be able to live together, that all men will be able to live together as brothers. You know, there are certain words in every academic discipline that soon become stereotypes and cliches. Every academic discipline has its technical vocabulary. Modern psychology has a word that is probably used more than any other word in modern psychology. It is the word maladjustment. You've heard that word. It is the ringing cry of modern child psychology. And certainly we all want to live well-adjusted lives in order to avoid neurotic and schizophrenic personalities. But I must say to you this evening, my friends, as I come to a close, that there are some things in my own nation, and there are some things in the world which I'm proud to be maladjusted, in which I call upon all men of goodwill to be maladjusted until the good society is realized. I must honestly say to you that I never intend to become adjusted to segregation, discrimination, colonialism, and these particular forces. I must honestly say to you that I never intend to adjust myself to religious bigotry. I must honestly say to you that I never intend to adjust myself to economic conditions that will take necessities from the many to give luxuries to. Your Majesty, Your Royal Highness, Mr. President, Excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, I accept the Nobel Prize for Peace at a moment when the heroes of the United States are engaged in a creative battle to end the long night of racial injustice. I accept this award on behalf of the civil rights movement, which is moving with determination and a majestic on for risk and danger to establish a reign of freedom and a rule of justice. I am mindful that only yesterday in Birmingham, Alabama, our children crying out for brotherhood were answered with fire hoses, snarling dogs, and even death. I am mindful that only yesterday in Philadelphia, Mississippi, young people seeking to secure the right to vote were brutalized and murdered. I am mindful that grinding poverty afflicts my people and chains them to the lowest rung of the economic ladder. Therefore, I must ask why this prize is awarded to a movement which is beleaguered and committed to unrelenting struggle, to a movement which has not yet won the very peace and brotherhood, which is the essence of the Nobel Prize. After contemplation, I conclude that this award, which I receive on behalf of that movement, is a profound recognition that nonviolence is the answer to the crucial political and moral questions of our time. The need for men to overcome oppression and violence without resorting to violence and oppression. Civilization and violence are antithetical concepts. Negroes of the United States, following the people of India, have demonstrated that nonviolence is not sterile passivity, but a powerful moral force which makes for social transformation. Sooner or later, all the peoples of the world will have to discover a way to live together in peace, thereby transform this pending cosmic elegy into a creative psalm of brotherhood. If this is to be achieved, man must evolve for all human conflict a method which rejects revenge, aggression, and retaliation. The foundation of such a method is love. The torturous road which has led from Montgomery, Alabama to Oslo bears witness to this truth. This is a road over which millions of Negroes are traveling to find a new sense of dignity. This same road has opened for all Americans a new era of progress and hope. It has led to a new civil rights bill. It will, I am convinced, be widened and lengthened into a superhighway of justice, as Negro and white men in increasing numbers create alliances to overcome their common problem. I accept this award today with an abiding faith in America and an audacious faith in the future of mankind. I refuse to accept despair as the final response to the ambiguities of history. I refuse to accept the idea that the isness of man's present nature makes him morally incapable of reaching for the eternal oughtness that forever confronts him. I refuse to accept the idea that man is mere flotsam and jetsam in the river of life, unable to influence the unfolding events which surround him. I refuse to accept the view that mankind is so tragically bound to the starless midnight of racism and war. The bright daybreak of peace and brotherhood can never become a reality. I refuse to accept the cynical notion that nation after nation must spiral down a militaristic stairway into the hell of nuclear annihilation. I believe that unarmed truth and unconditional love will have the final word in reality. Why right temporarily defeated is stronger than evil triumph. I believe that even amid today's mortar bursts and whining bullets, there is still hope for a brighter tomorrow. I believe that wounded justice, lying prostrate on the blood-flowing streets of our nation, can be lifted from this dust of shame to reign supreme among the children of men. I have the audacity to believe that peoples everywhere can have 3 meals a day for their bodies, education and culture for their minds, dignity, equality, and freedom for their spirit. I believe that what self-centered men have torn down, men other-centered can build up. I still believe that one day, mankind will bow before the altars of God, be crowned triumphant over war and bloodshed, nonviolent redemptive goodwill, proclaim the rule of the land. The lion and the lamb shall lie down together. Every man shall sit under his own vine and fig tree. None shall be afraid. I still believe that we shall overcome. This faith can give us courage to face the uncertainties of the future. It will give our tired feet new strength as we continue our forward stride toward the city of freedom. Our days become dreary with low-hovering clouds, and our nights become darker than a thousand midnights. We will know that we are living in the creative turmoil of a genuine civilization struggling to be born. Today I come to Oslo as a trustee, inspired and with renewed dedication to humanity. I accept this prize on behalf of all men who love peace and brotherhood. I say I come as a trustee, but in the depths of my heart, I am aware that this prize is much more than an honor to me personally. Every time I take a flight, I am always mindful of the many people who make a successful journey possible, the known pilots and the unknown ground crew. To honor the dedicated pilots, our struggle, who has set at the controls at the feet of movement, soared into orbit. You honor once again Chief Yutuli of South Africa, who struggles with and for his people, are still met with the most brutal expression of man's inhumanity to man. You honor the ground crew, without whose labor and sacrifice, death flights to freedom could never have left the earth. Most of these people will never make the headlines, Thy name to never appear.